This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
The Rabble Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Show your support by going to rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
The Civil War in Colombia started over five decades ago as a leftist rebellion against the government by the FARC guerrillas. Since then, the war has evolved to include many more groups, rebels, paramilitary, and drug mafia, with the FARC remaining the strongest opposing force. The conflict has claimed over 200,000 lives, displaced more than 5 million, and has destroyed generations of families. 2016 brought genuine hope that an end to the longest war in the Americas could come to an end when the FARC and the Colombian government signed a peace deal that was 4 years in the making. However, on October 2nd, by a very slim margin, Colombians voted to reject the peace accord in a national referendum. To tell us why is Mario Murillo. He is a professor of communications at Hofstra University, New York, and the author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. Mario joins us by phone from New York this morning. Hello, Mario.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Esther. Thanks for having me.
Colombia's opposition leader, Alvaro Uribe, led the No campaign. Why was he so against this peace deal?
Well, it's a complicated way to look at it. I mean, for one, Alvaro Uribe has been kind of the poster child of the anti-FARC, anti-subversion in Colombia. He was the president for 8 years, and under the leadership, led an all-out war against the FARC. He's got somewhat of a kind of a personal vendetta against the FARC because in the 1980s, his father was kidnapped in a botched kidnapping. He died. He was killed, and so he's sort of the face of the anti-communist, anti-rebel movement in Colombia that has a combination of extremely conservative political, economic, political, and social sensibilities, but also with a very strong military perspective of having to win this war and defeat the guerrillas militarily without any negotiation. So he has been adamant about and was a critic of the negotiations from the beginning, from the start of the four-year talks, as you described earlier in your introduction, and really mobilized his base, which is substantial in the country, to oppose it, really using tactics that could be described as fear tactics, propaganda, to kind of derail the peace accord, and obviously leading to the referendum vote that happened on October 2nd that you already described. So he had, you know, that's really where it comes from. But his opposition is shared by a number of people in high places in Colombia.
As you mentioned, Uribe was also the president of Colombia, and under his leadership, he led a demobilization of paramilitary forces with kind of a similar idea behind this peace deal with the FARC. How does that compare?
Well, you know, that's a good comparison. And in fact, a lot of people who were trying to point to the contradictions in Uribe's policy point to that specifically. The fact that the paramilitary groups, these are armed groups that emerged, I mean, they have their origins many, many decades back, but they really started emerging and becoming more of a kind of a national united front in the late 80s into the early 90s. And it's a combination of forces that include remnants of the military, remnants of the drug trafficking, sectors of the drug trafficking that looked at the guerrillas as infringing on their interest, and also the landed elite, the aristocracy that in many ways Uribe is directly connected politically and economically for many, many decades. And so that configuration of the paramilitaries who wage an all-out terrorist war, state-sponsored terrorist war against the civilian population in strongholds of the FARC had a substantial presence. Uribe came into office in 2002 saying he was going to negotiate with them and demobilize them as part of his democratic security strategy. A lot of people pointed to that as a contradiction. It's sort of like saying you're going to sit down and negotiate with yourself to try to end the violence. In any event, the mobilization took place. The United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, the AUC, does not exist as an organization anymore as a result of this negotiation. But the remnants, the many fighters who did not lay down their arms and still have a considerable presence in a lot of parts of the country, still maintain their armies of intimidation, particularly in areas where you have a lot of social unrest and social movement. So that is part of the contradiction, that Uribe was so adamantly opposed to surrendering or negotiating with the FARC and leading to impunity of FARC leaders, but in many ways he did the same thing with the right-wing paramilitary groups that in many ways did a lot more damage to the countryside than the FARC ever have.
So in addition to Uribe's no campaign, what were some of the other factors that contributed to the peace accord being voted down?
Well, you know, I take a position that it's really, you know, somebody asked me, I've been on a number of radio interviews, and somebody asked me that the other day, how is it possible that the Colombian people voted against peace? And my point is that, first of all, we have to look at the fact that there was only a 37% participation rate. In other words, there was over 62% abstention rate in the country on October 2nd. A lot of people did not vote. So that's one thing. The second thing is a lot of the areas, particularly on the Caribbean coast, where the majority of the people, it was like somewhere 75% to 80%, voted in favor of the peace agreement, a lot of them stayed home precisely because it was when Hurricane Matthew was hitting, so the conditions weren't ripe for going out to the polls. So we have to consider that as a factor. What would have happened if the storm wasn't hitting? And then the final factor is that if you look at the number of votes that were nullified, and this is something that was written in the Washington Post, but very few people have talked about it, and I haven't really heard much about it, but there was an interesting report analysis in the Washington Post about a week ago that points to the fact that over 220,000 votes were nullified, in other words, disqualified as a result. You know, there was something wrong with them, something wrong with the ballots. I mean, that happens in every election and around the world. And so if you can count 220,000 votes that were not counted, and you had a differential of about 53,000 votes, somebody should have called for a recount at least to say, wait a minute, this is not necessarily a reflection of what the people were wanting. And then I think finally the most important point is that it was a mistake to have probably called for the referendum in the first place, because it was so subject to a lot of manipulation, not voter manipulation in as much as messaging, right? And when we talk about really skewed propaganda that was used, really on both sides, but really from the no vote, that were essentially misinforming the Colombian public about what the peace accord meant, what was inside the peace accord, what it meant in terms of impunity, what it meant in terms of land restitution, what it meant on so many different levels. The possibility of misinformation was so great, and essentially, I think that's what happened. I think in many ways, there was a fear as to what would happen if the FARC were indeed incorporated into the political culture of Colombia, et cetera. So I think there was a lot of problems with the vote to begin with, and I think Santos overplayed his hand. The president overplayed his hand, thinking that this was going to be an easy win for the yes vote.
I want to go back to a point of you were saying that a hurricane prevented a lot of the rural community members from going out and voting. Why are the rural communities so much more supportive of this deal than their urban counterparts?
Well, there was a lot written about this. There's a number of different post-referendum analysis that said that if you look at the countryside and the areas, the regions where the most violence has occurred, where the people have been most victimized in terms of forced displacement, in terms of massacres, in terms of the violence of this 50-plus year war, violence from all sides. By the way, I'm not just attributing it to the FARC, but where the war has had the most impact, physically, economically, socially, on so many different levels, those areas of the country overwhelmingly voted in favor of ending it. In other words, signing the agreement, saying yes to the accord and moving forward and trying to deal with national reconciliation. And the areas where there was less, certainly in urban areas, and in particular in areas where Uribe has a very strong political base, those are the places where the no vote won. And in many ways, people make the argument that when you don't live the war firsthand, it's easy for you to say, yeah, we have to continue the war. But those people who live the war are the ones who have to, you know, say no. And I'll just use this one anecdote. I was in Cauca in August and speaking with a number of friends of mine from the indigenous movement in Colombia, many of whom have been directly victimized by both military, paramilitary, and FARC rebels, including one guy who was telling me how his sister was killed recently and killed, ironically, most likely by FARC guerrillas, some combatants that were still operating in the territories. And even he, unlike Uribe, even he was saying we still have to find a way to find peace to end this violence, to end this war. Whereas somebody like Uribe, and that's why the people who say, well, Uribe has a right to be angry and he has a right to say, you know, these guys are scoundrels, they killed his father. And I can just say, well, there's dozens and hundreds of people in Colombia, thousands of people in Colombia who've been victimized by this war, who are supporting and calling for an end to it. So it's a very complicated picture, but yes, indeed, those who are most affected by the war are the ones who are most in favor of ending it.
And you mentioned earlier that you felt that President Santos overplayed his hand by calling for a referendum. But despite the failure of the referendum, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize several days afterwards. What are your thoughts on that?
I think just like everything in Colombia, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. First of all, I think it was a big political victory for Santos to win it. Because a lot of people, even the Colombian press, including those sectors of the press that were critical of the peace agreement, they recognized this as a recognition of the country, right? And a country making an effort to bring peace to the country after so many years. So it was more like a national pride that Colombia and the president was named the Nobel laureate, and so that put a lot of political. He had a lot of political weight, gave him another political leg to stand on subsequent to the defeat in the referendum. Some people said, well, the referendum said no, the Nobel Committee acted too soon. But I think the sacrifices and the position that Santos had taken for 4 years was definitely warranted recognition. But what I was concerned about, and a lot of people were concerned about, was the fact that it doesn't recognize the role that Santos has played and had played for so many years as Uribe's defense minister, in which the war was waged at an extreme level, including many violations of crimes against humanity that were carried out under his watch. So in many ways, that whole portion of the track record, the political and strategic track record of Juan Manuel Santos was ignored, and once again made it look like he was the saint in this, and that the FARC were the bad guys once again. But ultimately, I think it's a good thing, and it actually did put a little, and it continues to put political pressure on even the opposition as they try to rehash some of the points in the accord.
How far away are Colombians from living in peace?
Well, I think what's going on is that you have a major, a lot of mobilization happening right now. After the October 2nd peace referendum led to the defeat of the yes vote, of the ending of the war and supporting the accord. Thousands upon thousands of people started hitting the streets. You started seeing protests in Bogota and in all the big cities. You started seeing students coming out, trade unionists. You started seeing the indigenous movement and other sectors coming out, doing street theater in the communities, wearing white, doing all sorts of things to demonstrate that they want this accord to move forward. It was sort of a wake-up call when they realized that so many people, that they lost the vote in the referendum. Suddenly people said, wait a minute, we don't want war. So we have that popular kind of clamor right now in Colombia, which is still going on. I mean, I'm watching the news very closely, and I see every day another major mobilization taking place. And I think what's the big problem here is that the right wing, and particularly under Uribe, who's now inserted into the process when he should not have been necessarily, now you have all these conditions that are being put forward that are not necessarily going to be agreed upon by the FARC, that also reverse a lot of the positive things about the accord relating to land restitution for people who've been displaced, relating to the fumigations of coca cultivations and how to deal with that in the countryside in terms of the transitional justice. All those issues that were very positive in terms of moving forward and trying to bring peace and reconciliation in Colombia, which will be a hard thing anyway. It's going to be a difficult, challenging road ahead anyway. But all of those now are being pushed back by Uribe because he's been fortified by this political victory, which is really a kind of a unfortunate set of circumstances. I hope that the international community, the UN, continues to stay on board. They're saying that they're going to stay in the areas of concentration where the FARC was supposed to demobilize. So one hopes that cooler heads will prevail and that ultimately they will move forward. But it has to be done soon. It can't be lingering on well into the next year, because at that point, then anything is going to happen, and the possibilities of violence breaking out again are pretty strong, especially as this gets more prolonged, deeper into 2017.
Well, Mario, thank you so much for joining us this morning and unpacking this very complex issue.
Well, I had a great time. Thank you so much, and I appreciate you looking at Colombia.
We've been speaking with Mario Murillo. He is a professor of communications at Hofstra University, New York, and the author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization.